Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What ideas and obligations are at the heart of Scientology? Famous for its cultivation of big-name entertainers and its climate of secrecy, the Church of Scientology was founded by L. Ron Hubbard, a self-proclaimed adventurer, science fiction writer, and occasional hypnotist whose self-help book Dianetics was rejected by the psychiatric establishment as junk science, but very popular with readers. Some of the ideas in Dianetics also found their way into the teachings of the Church of Scientology, which Hubbard founded in the 1950s and built into the deeply controversial international entity that has lasted for nearly two decades after his death. But what is Scientology exactly? Is it as widespread and influential as its leaders would have us believe? And is it any less a religion than more widely accepted spiritual traditions? Lawrence Wright began his exploration into the church for a piece he published 2 years ago in The New Yorker, at which he is a staff writer. Since then, he has expanded his investigation into a full-length book called Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. Larry, welcome back to Think.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's good to talk to you again.
What drew you to this story initially, and were you prepared from the beginning for the kind of resistance that you would get from the Church of Scientology?
Well, I've always been interested in why people believe what they do, especially in this country where you can believe anything you want. You know, it's not true in a lot of places in the world. You can believe one thing more or less. But in America, you know, we have this spiritual supermarket. And Scientology was always one of the most intriguing and esoteric of those beliefs. And I was very curious about it. Of course, I knew, you know, the church has a well-established reputation for being vindictive and litigious towards its critics and defectors and towards reporters. And so I was very aware of the obstacles that might be thrown into my path when I started this.
Regardless of one's opinions on Scientology, the story of L. Ron Hubbard is incredibly compelling.
Isn't it?
It really is. I mean, it's like fiction.
Yeah, it's an amazing life, and I'm really lucky to have had the opportunity to write about him.
Talk about, I guess, from early in his life, he thought of himself as a sort of legendary leader, starting when he was very young and planned to explore the Caribbean and its culture.
Oh, yeah. When he was a student at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., and although he didn't finish, while he was there, he started this thing called the Columbia Pictures Motion Picture Expedition. And it was a complete fiasco from the start. But he got all these young students to sign on to this motion picture expedition in the Caribbean. And they were going to go film things for, you know, voodoo ceremonies and so on, and have a great, and he said, collect whatever one collects for museums. They never actually accomplished any of that. It was a disaster from the start. But he showed that he had the ability to draw young people to him. He had this ambition to be the commander of this, you know, this enterprise, and also he had a love of the sea, which would manifest itself again and again in his life. And you know, even though everybody on the voyage thought it was a great disaster, he deemed it just a glorious adventure, as he said.
So, I mean, how much of that optimism was real, and how much of it was something that he later manufactured?
Well, you know, this is the odd thing about L. Ron Hubbard, is that there's this doubleness about his nature that's always present. You know, at one level, he had a very, you know, just realistically, had a very adventurous, intriguing life, but he always seemed to want to make it more than it actually was. So above this intriguing life he actually lived, he created a legendary life that was a little bit more than true, if you can say. And so, you know, you see this, for example, in his story about his experience in the war, in World War II, when he served in the Navy, and according to him, according to the legend that he created, he served gloriously in that war. and but he was badly injured, crippled and blinded, he said, after the war, and he was unable to be healed by medicine. So he healed himself using these techniques that he developed into Dianetics, his self-help program. And that's the legend that he created. And yet, when I was able to get hold of his medical records and his service record, he was never injured in the war. He did not serve with distinction, and he had conjunctivitis and ulcers, but not crippled and blinded.
Mm-hmm.
There's that the real life and the life that he promoted that he had lived.
I suppose these are not bad qualities for someone who will be a novelist, which was another aspect of his life.
Mm-hmm.
How good a writer was he?
Well, good is not exactly the word I would use. He was an intriguing and imaginative writer. One of his top qualities was speed. He wrote more than 100,000 words a month when he was working for the pulp magazines. That's where he really learned his craft. And at that time, in the 30s and the 40s, the pulps paid a penny a word. So you had to write a lot of words. And he would roll in a roll of butcher paper into his typewriter. And he typed so quickly that he perspired. It was a physical action for him. The net result of that kind of training is that he holds the Guinness Book of World Records for the number of books published, more than 1,000. So, he was speedy. He had a very fertile imagination. And he became a part of this sci-fi community that included Robert Heinlein and Isaac Asimov and many of the great names of that era.
Is there anything, Larry, in his early fiction that has resonance for what would become the belief system of the Church of Scientology?
Oh, yeah. Especially in his science fiction, you see many parallels with the cosmology that he developed for Scientology. The whole parable of Xenu, the galactic overlord, and, the galactic confederacy, all of these things are elements in some of his early stories.
So what made him so charismatic and able to convince people to, sail off with him when he had very little money and not much equipment and very little chance of success? What was it about his personality that drew people to him?
Well, he was very bluff and jovial. He could tell a good story. I think that he told stories people wanted to hear. I think that was a big secret to Scientology later on. But he would wrap up these great yarns. He could really spin a great story, and people loved being around him and hearing about these things, even if they acknowledged that it was most likely not true or exaggerated. They would always say that he really knew how to spin a yarn.
Talk about his journals, particularly those that, at least according to the Church of Scientology, are not authentic.
Well, there's after the war, in about 1945, 46, Hubbard began writing down some of these what looked like affirmations or hypnotic suggestions to himself. And the church, when they were first entered into a court record in the middle 80s, the church did not deny that they were real. They said they were just extremely private and inappropriate to be submitted as evidence. Now they say they're fraudulent. But these are, they are very intimate details of his inner life and his anxiety about, for instance, exaggerating his war record and his sexual habits, his proclivity, his affairs, his masturbation, his fears of snakes in the bottom of his bed. All of these things are dumped out. And in a way, what he's trying to do, you can see that he's trying to overcome all the limitations that he feels that he has. And in many respects, this prefigures the whole idea of Scientology, that you can supersede the normal human frailties that you have and become something greater than that, something kind of superhuman.
Yeah, he seems to have also, in those memoirs or those journals, have kind of dwelt on his fears of his own mortality.
Yeah, he did. He was frightened of death, which is understandable. He was complicated where women were concerned. His whole life would be, marred by these relationships that were, he was married three times and once a bigamist. He really did have difficulty with women, and I think he was struggling to be a better man. And I think, I think it's unfortunate that the church has decided to cast these affirmations aside, because one can look at them and really identify with L. Ron Hubbard, the man, in a way you can't with L. Ron Hubbard, the legend.
How did he develop his skills as a hypnotist? Of others, not of himself.
Well, this was a time when stage hypnotism was very popular, and Hubbard seemed to have a real knack for it. One time in San Francisco, he was addressing a group of sci-fi fans, and he was at that time one of the best known sci-fi writers in America, and he hypnotized much of the audience and persuaded one man that he was holding some miniature kangaroos in the palm of his hand, and had another man take off his jacket and hat with post-hypnotic suggestions. Apparently he was very persuasive, and some people think that was part of the secret of his success, is his hypnotic powers.
So essentially anyone in his presence not necessarily would be hypnotized, but would find it hard to sort of turn their attention away from him.
Yeah, I think if you saw The Master, the movie that is sort of based on Hubbard's life, I thought Philip Seymour Hoffman did a wonderful job of conveying that quality of, a charismatic leadership that is, in some respects, a little repellent, but on the other hand, very difficult to break free from.
So let's talk, Larry, about Dianetics, the book and then the seminars that related to it. Hubbard contended that all of us have, a reactive mind and a more analytical mind.
Yeah, this is his fundamental insight into human nature, however flawed it might be. But his notion was that we have this divided mentality. On the one hand, we have the rational, analytic mind, and it's a perfect computer. It remembers everything with absolute accuracy. And then, on the other hand, there is our reactive mind, and this is where our fears and neuroses reside, and they're the result of experiences that we've had in this life or previous ones, which color our perceptions and distort our thinking. His idea was that you could surface these experiences in a kind of therapeutic Dianetic situation, and drain them of their power to control you, and gradually you would clear your reactive mind, and when it was finally clear, you would have, in his term, gone clear, and you would be more intelligent. Your reaction times would be greater. You'd be immune to diseases. Your eyesight would be better, and all of these things were forecast, although he had a very difficult time of producing any examples of anybody who had actually gone clear.
Lawrence Wright is my guest. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and staff writer for The New Yorker. His new book is called Going Clear: Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. SMU.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Pulitzer Prize-winning author Lawrence Wright. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of the new book Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Larry, the Church of Scientology has a famously contentious relationship to the psychiatric professions.
Yes.
And I gather this started when Dianetics was rejected as junk science.
Yeah, when Hubbard published his, even before he published his book, Dianetics, in 1950, he sent the manuscript to the American Psychological and American Psychiatric Associations. And with the idea that they were going to hail him as the, you know, like the next Freud, you know, a brilliant innovator in the field. And they looked at it as psychological folk art. They could not make heads or tails of it because it made reference to studies that never took place and had, you know, some rather bizarre ideas about human nature that were unsubstantiated. And so they made fun of it, and this wound never healed with Hubbard. After that, he decided that psychiatry was the root of all evil in the human condition. You know, it includes, you know, war, terrorism, plague, you know, everything that is wrong with humanity is the fault of psychiatrists who are trying to take over the world. And this manifests itself in, you know, for instance, the campaign that Scientology has never stopped against psychiatric medicines and antidepressants and so on. All of this is attached to the fact that Hubbard developed this overpowering fear and hatred of the psychiatric profession.
That did not keep the book from selling like crazy, the fact that
it was disdained
by the scientific establishment.
Maybe the opposite. It was a huge sensation. It really dominated the New York Times bestseller list, and in many ways set created the whole category of self-help books that became so popular after World War II. And it was sort of contemporary with the hula hoop and, you know, had the same kind of widespread, you know, just burn through the culture. There were Dianetics clubs that started up all over the country and in other countries. And Hubbard made millions out of it, but then lost them and even lost the control of the name Dianetics for a while.
And so he lost control. He wasn't making a lot of money after a while. I mean, I don't know how much of a leap we can make from the I need money to let's start a church.
Well, here's the thing. Many times Hubbard said that, you know, that he'd like to start a religion because that's where the money is. He saw the tax advantages and that kind of thing. But the truth is, if he really was just a con man, at some point he would have simply taken the money and run, and he never actually did that. He spent his whole life elaborating this esoteric doctrine and the bureaucracy that undergirds the Church of Scientology. So whatever you think of him, he was, I think, very convinced of his own doctrine.
So how did these ideas, how did he formulate them and refine them and turn them into something that he decided to spread?
Well, you know, when he started the church, he didn't really have very clear ideas about what Scientology was. He had certain premises, and one was that we are immortal creatures. We are called Thetans. It's a spirit, and we're not our body, we're not our mind, you know, we are something else that inhabits a body, but we have lived before and we'll live again. And that was his most important insight. He also had access to something called an e-meter, which had one of his followers had developed. It's like one-third of a lie detector. And because it measures your galvanic skin responses, it's two metal cans. They used to be Campbell soup cans with the labels scraped off. And they're attached to by electrical wires to a meter, and a needle shows, actually shows the moisture content of your skin, but according to Scientology, it detects the mental mass of your thoughts. And with this instrument, Hubbard began exploring his own inner terrain, looking at the needle to see if he could imagine, you know, what was going on inside his mind. It became his tool of inner exploration. And whatever, you know, if you think it's all just conjecture on his part, you know, he was coming up with these amazing ideas about this galactic overlord in, you know, 75 million years ago, and envisioning this whole cosmology that became the belief system of the Church of Scientology. But what I want to emphasize is it was an evolving thing. He started the church in 1954. The Xenu idea he didn't actually come up with until the middle 60s. So there was a long period of time when he was, you know, in the process of creating this church, and his followers were in a state of constant expectation, wondering what he's going to come up with next.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking this hour with author Lawrence Wright about his new book, Going Clear. Let's go on the phone now to Michael in Dallas. Hi, Michael.
Hi there. Great program, and I wanted to just make a real quick observation, and I guess it will lend itself to some elaboration on some comments, but I just am always amazed at people in general falling for any kind of religion, because my opinion is every one of them is false. It's all a con. And I'd like to hear your guest just speak to not only why he thinks Hubbard did what he did, but what is it about the human condition that makes people just suspend their reasoning power and all that to join religions in the first place? And I hang up and listen on the air.
Thank you, Michael. Those are sweeping statements. I don't know how much of that you want to take on, Larry.
Well, let me say this. I grew up in Dallas, and when I was a teenager, I was very religious, and I knew what that experience was like. And although I've moved away from those kinds of formal belief systems as a reporter, I've always been impressed by the power of religious beliefs to transform individuals and societies far more extensively and thoroughgoingly than politics, which is something that's a subject of obsession for most journalists. So, you know, I understand that religion is an extraordinary, powerful force, and what draws people to these different belief systems. One thing is, you know, that religion offers the hope of forgiveness and transformation, salvation. You know, these are, you know, ineffable qualities, but there's obviously in the human condition a great longing for those things. The other thing about Scientology, you know, people sneer at its esoteric belief system, and it really is very odd. But there are many religions with bizarre, one might even say that all religion has, you know, its irrational elements, and if, you know, examined closely, they will seem very, very strange. But if you accept those beliefs, if you say, yes, I believe, say, if you want to join the Mormon Church, well, yes, I accept the idea that we can convert the dead and that Jesus came to America and, you know, things that most people don't agree with, you step across a line into a religious community that is there to receive you. And it can be a wonderful community. Like the Mormon community is very supportive. And inside, you know, you're only separated from the rest of the society by your beliefs, not by language or race or anything. It's only your beliefs that mark you as a distinctive group. That can be, you know, a very powerful way of joining a community of like-minded people. And inside that community, you know, you have your society, your friends, and so on. That is one of the attractions of religion that I think people don't understand. You know, if you become a member of Jehovah's Witnesses or any of these stigmatized groups, the more stigmatized they are sometimes, that's part of what makes the society inside that community cohere. And it may be one reason why mainstream denominations have been declining and more rigid, and one might say far-out religions have been growing.
Larry, what explains the relationship between Scientology and the entertainment industry?
Well, this is key to understanding Scientology and Hubbard's original idea. When he established the Church of Scientology in Los Angeles in 1954, there was a reason for that. He was himself always attracted to the movie industry and did some script writing and always hoped to be a director. He established the Celebrity Center, which is Scientology course, you know, a school of sorts in Hollywood, for that same reason. And early on in the church's history, the Scientology magazine published a roster of prospective Scientologists that they would like to have in the church, and they included Bob Hope, Walt Disney, Marlene Dietrich, Howard Hughes, John Ford. I mean, the most famous people in the industry, some of the most famous people in the world. All along, Hubbard understood that celebrity itself was something that was worshipped in America, mm-hmm. and that Hollywood was the center of that. And if he could get in the middle of that and create a church that was designed to draw in celebrities, that he would be a success.
So one of the people that you spend a great deal of time with, or did for the purposes of this book and the article that preceded it, was the screenwriter and director Paul Haggis.
Right.
Talk about how he got involved in Scientology.
He was a young man in London, Ontario, and he was, he was an aspiring photographer at the time, but he was walking down the street downtown, and he ran into a young man named Jim Logan, who was standing out on the street corner selling copies of Dianetics. And so he sold a copy to Paul, and inside the cover there was a stamp saying Church of Scientology, and Paul had heard of Scientology, and so he asked if he could. He was curious, he wanted to find out about it. So like a lot of people, he went into the church skeptically, you know, wondering what's going on inside it. And if you enter the Church of Scientology, what they will typically do is ask you, what is ruining your life? What is your ruin, as they say? What is standing in the way of your financial, relational, spiritual, emotional progress? And most people have something. And Scientology offers a menu of courses that might help you, and therapy that's called auditing. And many people are helped. Paul felt that, you know, he had a relational problem with his girlfriend, and so when they joined the church, you know, they spent a lot of time taking communications courses, and he felt that it actually helped. Even people like Jerry Seinfeld, who is not a Scientologist now, but took some courses, credits the church with helping him get the confidence he needed to become a stand-up comedian. So, you know, there's certainly an entry into the church which can provide something that people seem to need.
Those courses do not come cheap.
No, they don't. Although you can go in and not spend a lot of money at the very beginning, but if you follow the breadcrumb trail up to, the ladder of enlightenment, if I can mix my metaphors, by the time you get to the top of the Scientology spiritual pyramid, you may set aside about $500,000, and that doesn't include the auditing that the church suggests very strongly that you take, which is very expensive. If you have to buy the works of L. Ron Hubbard and in these glossy editions, and there are more than 1,000 books if you get all the way into it. You buy an e-meter, you join the International Association of Scientologists, and you're repeatedly, forcefully encouraged to contribute to the building fund or various charitable drives that the church maintains. So many people spend millions of dollars on Scientology, and it's a very common experience, and it's one of the reasons people are very reluctant to leave it, because after they've invested so much emotional and financial resources into the church, it's difficult to break away.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with James in Plano. Hi, James.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thank you.
I'm really fascinated by all this. In fact, I think I'm driving my wife nuts because I'm grabbing all kinds of stuff to read on it as I'm getting into it more and more and finding all kinds of websites. And one of the things, well, there's a bunch of things I'd love to ask you back in time, but one of the things I'm curious about is that I've seen that there are a lot of reports of David Miscavige, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right, as the head, current head of Scientology, as being physically abusive to the people around him, beating them and things, and I'm wondering why there are never any criminal charges for that or for the place called The Hole, where they seem to hold people indefinitely until they feel like they can be released or the people finally escape.
I'd be happy to respond to that. Let me explain a little before I sort of set the scene so I can explain this answer. Inside Scientology, there's a clergy, and it's called the C Organization, or C Org. It comes from the time when Hubbard was on the high seas and a little Scientology Navy, and the people that were serving with him became the clergy. And the headquarters for the Sea Org is in a desert compound in Southern California. And there, people are, you know, that's where the top executives are. And inside there is a double-wide trailer where a lot of the executives have been confined involuntarily, sometimes for years on end. And David Miscavige, I had 12 people tell me that he beat them, and I've had more than 20 who said they witnessed such behavior.
Let me jump in here. We need to take a quick break. My guest is Lawrence Wright, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author and staff writer for The New Yorker, whose new book is called Going Clear: Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. You can join us via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. smu.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with The New Yorker's Lawrence Wright about his new book, Going Clear: Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. And Larry, before the break, you were telling us about David Miscavige, who took over as head of Scientology when he was still in his mid-20s upon the death of L. Ron Hubbard.
Right. He was he joined the church as a very young teenager and became a member of the Sea Org when he was 16. That's the clerical group. He dropped out of school, like many people who joined the Sea Org, he was young. There are some that join the Sea Org when they're like as young as six. They sign a contract for 1 billion years of service. And so he did that when he was 16 and became, Hubbard, as I said, had an interest in motion pictures. And so he didn't have much success in Hollywood, but he created his own movie studio. And David Miscavige became his chief cameraman. And in that way, he got to be close to Hubbard. And then Hubbard began giving him assignments that would sort of undercover assignments inside Scientology. So he became a confidant of Hubbard's. Eventually, when Hubbard decided to go into hiding in 1980, David Miscavige was one of two people who was a part of the link between Hubbard and the outside world. So he really controlled the church by being the gatekeeper.
And you said you have documentation from, it sounds like, a couple dozen people that Miscavige had been physically abusive.
I had 12 people who said that they had been beaten by David Miscavige, and 20 who witnessed it.
Mm-hmm.
It's extraordinary. And, you know, I think, you know, one of the questions one of the callers asked was, you know, why didn't anybody do anything about it? If you picture this remote desert compound where the Sea Org maintains its headquarters and where these abuses mostly took place, the people that are inside that compound are, you know, first of all, they've signed these contracts for 1 billion years of service, so their dedication to the church can't be doubted.
Right.
They mostly have grown up inside the Sea Org or inside Scientology, and all of their family members are probably in Scientology, most of their friends, maybe all of them. So their community is there. And if they were to leave the church or draw attention by calling the sheriff, for instance, none of those people would ever speak to them again. They've been taught that Scientology holds the keys to their salvation. They're impoverished. They have no education. They may not even have a driver's license. And they know very little about the world outside the gates and this, you know, fortified compound. If they try to escape, they are often brought back and confined in these re-education camps that the church maintains, sometimes for years on end. If they decide to leave and say, "I quit," the church will say, "Then here you should sign this," and it'll be a list of what many former members say is a list of crimes they didn't commit, but something that the church would be able to use against them in the future, and then given a bill for the services rendered, and it's called the freeloaders tab, and often in excess of $100,000. I mean, it's completely out of the reach of these impoverished clerical workers. So it's a, you know, there are many reasons why people don't call the police, but there are, you know, a number of abuses that seem very well substantiated, and I think regardless of the legal situation, the Church of Scientology has to have an accounting for what's going on inside the top tier of their organization.
Can you talk, Larry, about the discrepancy you found between the membership that the Church of Scientology claims and the membership that is sort of able to be externally verified?
The church claims 8 to 10 million members worldwide. They claim more than 4 million people become Scientologists every year. But if you look at the poll data inside the U.S., only 25,000 people identify themselves as Scientologists, which is less than half the number who say they're Rastafarians. And the number of people in the entire world who are members of the International Association of Scientologists, which is probably the best indicator of, you know, real affiliation, according to former members, it's only about 30,000. So one can say that the membership of the Church of Scientology is somewhere between 30,000 and 10 million. I think there are more than the 30,000. I don't think it's as small as that because of, you know, just simply, you know, anecdotally, so many people coming up to me and writing me about, you know, their experiences in the church and how many families have been broken apart by the church's policies of disconnection from members that, from family members that don't agree with the church's behavior. However big it is, the effect that it has on these families is quite profound.
One of the reasons that Paul Haggis left was he was really disappointed with the intolerant policy of the church toward homosexuality. In defense of Scientology, are they any less tolerant of homosexuality than a lot of other mainstream religions that people don't question?
Oh, no, I agree with that. I think, you know, for one thing, Scientology reflects the culture that L. Ron Hubbard was in the 1950s when he created the church. And at that time, the mental health profession, for instance, regarded homosexuality as a form of insanity, and most people thought of gays as being perverts. And in some of the literature that Hubbard wrote, employed those prejudices. And although the church has tried to purge some of that, it's, you know, in the culture of the church, it's still present. And you know, it's not, you know, certainly there are many, many different religions that have expressed prejudice against gays, and Scientology is not alone in that regard.
Let's go back to the phones now, 1-800-933-5372. We have Dave on the line in Dallas. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Enjoy the show.
Thank you.
I was involved with I did some courses at the Church of Scientology in Los Angeles back in probably the late 80s, and walked away, have not had any exposure to them, and they have all of a sudden started calling about all 3 months ago and are just relentless, and they found me all the way in Texas. Is that part of their techniques?
Yes. In short, Scientology is very good at tracking down former members or people who have had anything to do with the church, even at the smallest level. And, you know, you're likely to be followed by mailers and phone calls for the rest of your life. You have to understand the pressure that people inside Scientology are under to raise money. There's constant, in these call centers that the church maintains, people aren't allowed to go to bed until they've raised a certain amount of money. They have to sell these books that Hubbard wrote. There's, you know, quotas that each mission inside the church has to achieve, and if by Thursday afternoon at 2 o'clock you have not reached your quota, you're in trouble. And you know, the church is run by statistics, and you're supposed to be in a state of constantly rising achievement. And if part of your job is to raise money for the church, you have to raise more money every month.
And all of that money is tax-free.
Well, almost all of it. But the church, you know, it has been recognized by the IRS in 1993 as a tax, you know, as a tax exempt religious organization. And the story of how that happened is really telling. By 1993, the church, which had decided not to pay its taxes, was $1 billion in arrears, and it didn't have $1 billion. So it was an existential moment, and we wouldn't be talking about the Church of Scientology now if they had not gotten their exemption. The way that David Miscavige went about it was to launch more than 2,300 lawsuits against the IRS and individual agents, to hire private investigators, to follow agents around, and whatever the merits of the, you know, the judgment of the IRS was, you know, the part of the deal was that the lawsuits would be dropped and the private investigators called off, and the church was, $1 billion was forgiven, and the church was awarded the status of being a religion, and with that came the vast protections of the First Amendment, religious guarantees, and is that, you know, the exemption plus the protections of the First Amendment that allow the Church of Scientology to exist today.
Where does that money go, Larry? I mean, my understanding is they're not, you know, broadly feeding the hungry or sheltering orphans. How do they spend that money?
Well, much of the money goes into offshore accounts, you know, according to former executives. This nest egg of $1 billion they have now raised is in put in safekeeping. They do have certain projects for drug rehabilitation and criminal rehabilitation and so on, but you know, their drug program is a money-making enterprise, so it's not exactly a charitable organization. It doesn't even really depict itself that way, but the amount of money the church has is a source of conflict with some of the members who are tired of being constantly beleaguered by these appeals for money, when the church has lots and lots of it. And, you know, what the church is rich in besides cash, is lawyers. But what it is suffering from, in my opinion, is a dearth of membership, that it may be it's going to take this organization to its extinction if it doesn't turn around.
What's it like for a kid to be raised in Scientology from birth?
Well, you know, there's a new book by Jenna Miscavige Hill, who is the niece of David Miscavige, and it's a heartbreaking tale. And I've talked to many other people who have grown up inside the church. Hubbard had an idea that children were no different from adults. They were just small, and they should be treated exactly as adults. And that's the way he did treat them. When he was on his ship in the Mediterranean, where he spent about a decade on the high seas, when children on the ship committed an infraction, he would sometimes put them in the what he called the anchor hold, which is where the anchor is stored, and it's cold and dark and dank and dangerous. If the anchor chain were to slip, you know, a child could be mutilated. And he would put children in there alone, some days, sometimes more than a week at a time, for some minor infraction. Children became a real source of contention inside the Sea Org, and eventually they were, you know, Sea Org members were forbidden to have children. But those who were already in were raised on a ranch. I should not say they were raised. They were essentially raising themselves. It was a kid ranch that was near the compound in Southern California, but they saw their parents only once a week for a few hours, and had very little adult supervision. They essentially built their facilities and taught themselves, and you can imagine, you know, their education was very incomplete. Now, although the Sea Org does not want to have infants inside it, they do recruit children at very young ages. And I talked to a young man named Daniel Montalvo, who joined the Sea Org when he was 11. And one of his early duties when he was sent to Clearwater, Florida, which is where the church maintains its spiritual headquarters, was one of his tasks was to clean out the asbestos from the hotel they purchased there. And he said he got no protective equipment. He later, when he was 16, he was working the night shift at a printing plant the church owns. He chopped off a finger with one of these, you know, a piece of heavy equipment that he had no business being around. And the church says it doesn't violate the child labor laws, but I don't understand how that could be true.
Lawrence Wright is a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of the new book, Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. Larry, it's always great to have you on the show. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be home again, Chris. Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can download the podcast and learn more about the show at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.